Hello and welcome to On The Ball, the Norwich City podcast that got excited about corners before it was cool. Well, that was an Easter weekend of two halves, wasn't it? A good Friday against Plymouth, followed by a blue Monday at Leicester that has left Norwich City roughly where they started, in sixth place with a cushion of 4 points down to seventh. Not ideal for those of us with an hour-long podcast to fill, but there were plenty of talking points to keep things interesting, with comebacks, collapses, the emergence of Andy Hughes as some sort of set-piece Da Vinci, and possibly the greatest free-kick goal that never was. And of course, once we run out of things to talk about from the last 4 days, there's always what's coming up in the next 4 days. Almost certainly the biggest East Anglian derby since the 2015 playoffs against a team who can't stop scoring last-minute winners. We'll ask our panel whether they're embracing it or dreading it. I think I already know the answer in one of their cases. Plus, Sergeant breaking records. We'll assess the injury list. No more horseplay for Ashley Barnes. And it's our first podcast since those depressing Stuart Webber comments. We'll try somehow to sum all of that up. I'm Steve Sanders, a.k.a. at NCFC Numbers. And in the spirit of Easter, we've rolled away the stone and resurrected a couple of Norwich City experts with a few disciples of their own. Our first guest is a man who admitted to being sick on a tube train when no one else was in the carriage in our WhatsApp chat yesterday. And I've asked him if it's okay to bring it up, and he said it's fine. I'm now hoping he's going to elaborate on that that story. You guessed it. It's Dan Brigham.
Hi, Steve. Well, you've thrown me into a pretty murky deep end there, haven't you, with bringing that up. It was a tortuous analogy about Norwich City losing yesterday but getting away with it because all the other teams lost around them, much like the time I was on the tube on my way home from a heavy night and made an incident of myself into my hands on a tube, but it was empty, so I got away with it entirely. So what sometimes your luck's in.
And what did you do with what was in your hands? How did that end?
This is a hell of a start. That there was probably general wipage. Probably ashamed to admit most of the wiping happened on public seating, I think. But you know, when you get yourself into incidents like that, you're only going to get out of it in one way, aren't you? And that's embarrassing yourself.
Well, it sounds like you, as you say, mostly got away with it. I think we've all got at least one story like that, but I haven't revealed mine in the WhatsApp group yet, so apologies for making you relive that moment. Yes, it's the only Norwich City podcast where you'll get the phrase general wipage in the first couple of minutes, so hopefully more of that to come. Secondly, a man who last time he was on, from memory, made Dan look like the optimistic one, and that was after a win, so looking forward to more upbeat takes from former EDP editor-in-chief and CEO of the Norfolk Community Law Service, Dave Powles. Dave, lovely to have you back on. How are you doing?
Yeah, really nice to be back. That's really, like I said at the time, that was really unlike me. I'm a very optimistic fan normally, and I think that maybe feel back in a better place today, but I will never ever be revealing any secrets to you guys at all from here on in. Not that I have any anyway, because I've led a monk's life, of course.
Of course, that's why we get you on with Dan. It's the juxtaposition that works so well. We'll see how the next hour goes in terms of further confessions, but I guess we're here to talk about the football, so let's do that with our headline act. A topsy-turvy weekend then, with Norwich City behind for 57 minutes in a game that they won and then in front for 14 minutes in a game that they lost. That seems to have been the way of it this season. They've gained 21 points from losing positions, without which they'd be 19th, and 28 points lost from winning positions, without which they would be top. Well, there you go. Those are some alternate universes for you there. We'll start with the game at the King Power with our make-believe title rivals, Leicester. Gabriel Sarr gave Norwich City the lead from a corner before Dewsbury Hall, Mavadidi and Vardy swung the game for the home side. Dan, a second defeat in 11 games. I think it's fair to say that it was probably a deserved one. Your assessment might be different to mine, but I ask you the question first. So how did that one get away from Norwich City?
£89 million of debt, I think. That's how, which is what Leicester City have been reported today of being in. And you can see why when, and this is introducing caveats to the defeat, they've got a disgustingly outstanding squad, not just first 11 as well. Some of the names on the bench were mid-table Premier League players. and we look like what we were, which is a sort of team trying to get into the playoffs against a team that probably should have stayed up in the Premier League last season. But it was disappointing, though, despite this sort of gulf in spending and in sort of names on paper. Well, we went in with 7 wins in our last 10, Leicester City with 4 defeats in their last 6, dropping out the top 2 for the first time since, September? Obviously, fragile confidence. We take the lead, and then it just, any positivity evaporated after that, you know. I think the biggest disappointment for me is that we've been shown we're capable of playing well against good teams over the last couple of months. Beat Coventry, beat West Brom, playing pretty decent football. Deservedly beat those teams, playing sort of front foot football as well, not setting up to sort of nick a point. So that the most disappointing aspect is that the progress that we've made over the last 2 months or 6 weeks just wasn't on show whatsoever. And I think obviously my initial reaction was to blame Wagner, and I maintain that, but the players weren't brave enough and weren't bold enough as well when they're on the ball, just not good enough on the ball as well. So we'll get into the where's and why's, I guess. But yeah, it was disappointing. I think probably most of us would have taken a point at the start of the day, but it really looked like we set out to get a point as well, which is never a very good way to start a football match. It's a very Chris Hughton way to start a football match. You know, we may have gone for it and still lost. Hull went for it at Leeds yesterday and lost 3-1. We didn't go for it and lost 3-1 at Leicester. But I would like to have seen that sort of progress we've made over the last 6 weeks and encapsulated in a really good performance against a team that shouldn't be in this division.
Yeah, and I think that, like you say, having taken the lead, that was maybe the moment that we could have seized it in the game, really, once Leicester equalised, completely got away from us. Dave, I mean, Dan's touched on both sides there. How much of it was down to tactics and how much of it was us just kind of not turning up on the day, do you think?
Well, I think you can use the evidence of the rest of the season to say that a lot of it is down to failure of tactics. I think we've got the juxtaposition of Wagner and the team, haven't we, that they've found that formula at home and know exactly what to do to get that win. But away from home, he doesn't seem able to change it, doesn't seem able to try a different style. And, you know, that's been a real problem all season. So I think it obviously it's down to the players, but I think that Wagner has to take that on the chin, given that it's been like that all season. I felt that we actually started off really well and had no issue with how we started the game, obviously, you know, shown by the fact we took the lead. It was just how we then reacted. And for me, the bit that I found most depressing was that there was no plan B. There was no, what do we do if we go 2-1 behind? It showed how small our squad is. There's so little on the bench. And I felt that against Plymouth as well, and we'll come on to that in a bit, I know, but there's so little on the bench at the minute. And for whatever reason, I don't feel that he really trusts what is on the bench. I mean, to have a striker on there who 8 weeks ago everyone was sort of, you know, getting the letters ready to print on the back of their shirts. And I think he's probably had 70 minutes of game time since, and most of that was against Rotherham in the second half. That was, you know, the game was already out of the picture. For me, shows that there's not faith in those players on the bench. So the most disappointing thing for me wasn't that we went 2-1 behind, it was that we never really did anything after that, and we never at any point looked like we could make it to the wall. And you know, I felt we watched it in a house full, and I think everyone was pretty switched off pretty quickly because they realised that Norwich were going nowhere.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone did get Van Hooijdonk on the back of their shirt after he arrived. It's a lot of letters.
£224 badly spent. I don't reckon he's coming back after this end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a very good point. They used the same 14 players, didn't they, in the two games, and nobody else. And, you know, looks like the Eda loan is working out from the perspective that he is getting game time, and that's something that he badly needed. But does seem, well, just the fact that we've hardly seen Van Hooijdonk, it does seem like there's a player who isn't trusted.
I found that really interesting because even when Eda was here and the players were fit, he very much rotated. And actually, I remember looking at the stats when Eda left, and he was something like the 6th or 7th most used player in terms of game time when he left. But he just wasn't starting many games. But But by pleasing Eder to go abroad and bringing in Van Hooydonk, it has, you would say in some respects, it's backfired, because I know Sargent and Barnes have been doing a really good job, but we've massively narrowed our options. Eder was coming on and scoring goals as a substitute. Van Hooydonk's not even coming on and at all. So that has to go down as a bad decision for the club, really, despite the fact that we've been playing better since.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, that was the opportunity to bring him in, wasn't it? When as you say, the system wasn't working clearly yesterday, and you've got a striker on the bench who you could either throw on for Sargent, like for like, or change things up a little bit. And yeah, there's a definite lack of trust there, and I think that's an issue. Yeah, I mean, Leicester, as we said, very, very strong. And I think, I mean, I was looking at, I'd had heard from Leicester fans before the game that they weren't too worried insofar as the games that they'd lost, they'd still created chances. I looked at their XG and it did seem very much as though, you know, they were creating them and just not scoring them. So, and I completely agree with you, Dan. I think once you add that in to the fact that they've got excellent players already, I think, you know, they completely strangled us with the press. I think they didn't let us play out. And then in midfield, I think they just completely got on top of us. We've said a lot of times on this podcast about Kenny, haven't we? How good has he been this season? But stick him up against Premier League opposition and it's a bit of a different story. Go on, Dan.
Oh, and not only that, it's kind of the repetition from this season. A lot of the time is, as you say, we struggle to get out, but we didn't have many men in midfield, and that happens a lot. And it shows against the really good teams, you need an extra man in there. And I could understand why he went for the same 11, irrespective of, you know, tiredness, etc. But why he went for a confident winning 11, I could understand that. But when it became clear that we were trying to play our usual transitional football, but without seemingly trying to force any turnovers, like trying to win the ball back. And when we did win the ball back, we'd lose it. Because you've got Ashley Barnes as a kind of pointless second striker. And Ashley Barnes has got many, many, or some positives. There is a man who would never vomit on public transport. He's far too nice for that, I'd imagine.
We don't know what he's been banned from horse racing for yet, do we? So.
Yeah. Does riding a horse, does that count as public transport? Depends where you're going, I suppose, yeah, isn't it?
Transport in public, isn't it?
When you're relying on, you cannot rely on Ashley Barnes to link play. That's not his game when you're trying to get out quickly. He is not your Madison or your Wes or your Emmy or your Steeperman. He is not going to link play. That's just not what he's good at. And it soon became clear that we were, A, not getting the ball back. And when we were getting the ball back, we were losing it again. So just, we waited until we were behind to change it. We should have brought on another midfielder, I think, to just try and get another footballer in there. And that's down to the manager, I think. And sort of exposed by a better team that sort of knew how to keep the ball. In mitigation, and we do, that was a game we really missed Johnny Rowe, I think. Someone who can properly carry the ball. And Onel to some extent as well, someone who can also carry the ball a bit. But we didn't really have that threat. And when you're trying to play on the counter, you do need that threat. Apart from Sines, who I thought was probably our most effective attacking player, we didn't really have anyone else to make any inroads.
And Sarah, I think, had, if not his fewest, then I think maybe second fewest touches of any game this season, just not involved. And obviously you kind of, you strangle him and our game plan is kind of strangled. So, yeah, I mean, Dave, I mean, if you read Twitter, then we can obviously give up on, even if we get sixth, give up on the playoffs now. We've got absolutely no chance. obviously being slightly flippant there, but I guess this is a reminder of just, if we do get that sixth place, and there's still a lot of work to do there, just how difficult it will be. Because obviously, as things stand, if you finish the season out, which would be a weird time to do it because we haven't all played the same number of games, it would be Norwich City versus Leicester City, and we'd be heading back there on the 16th of May. So, yeah, that just the gulf was evident, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, I still think Leicester will be up there. In the top two anyway, personally. But then I predicted that Norwich would be falling away massively by now when I was last on this podcast, so what do I know? but yeah, I think you're right. But it's a bit, I feel the same about the playoffs as I feel about Ipswich on Saturday, which I know we're coming on to, that it's just another world. Everything else that's happened before just can almost go out of the window. So I agree with that to a point, but equally just weird things happen to teams in playoffs. Weird results happen. God, last season there were some phenomenal turnarounds from three goals down Peterborough. And so yeah, you just don't know. There is a gulf, but in those two games, nerves must take to effect. Confidence becomes a big player. So I don't know, if we do get in the playoffs, I don't know what I fear most, the fact that we might win them or the fact that we might not.
Well, if Frank Lampard's Derby can beat Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds, then anything's possible. And while we're on the positives, let's talk about the goal, right? The corner was, basically straight out of the Man City playbook, wasn't it? It's like Andy Hughes watched that City versus Fantastic. Liverpool game and said, we'll have a bit of that. Dan, you know, we're good at corners. What's going on?
Yeah, I normally like it's us kind of inventing the corner as well. But it's nice to see that a good old copycat corner works as well, doing the same routine. Brilliantly worked, as was the Fastnacht corner against Plymouth as well, which created one of the great noises in football, which is a groan immediately followed by cheers when we've scored as well. Because I think a lot of people thought he'd mishit it, but in actual fact, he'd picked out Sargent really, really well. And is it only Cardiff that have scored more?
I missed the goal. I will have
groaning too much, were you, Dave?
No, I was my youngest lad.
We
play a corner game where every time there's a corner, you swap money. Unfortunately, he dropped the money just as that corner went. So me and my 8-year-old son spent the corner on the floor trying to find this pound, as all of a sudden I heard everyone cheering and jumped up with my pound in my hand. And I completely missed it.
Do you swap the same amount of money, or is it like a kind of superstitious ritual?
Well, this,
or
is, again, no, this is a game that was born out of going to, I remember it the first time I played it with a group of friends. It was Bury versus Northampton on a cold November. Don't ask me why we were watching that game. We were in Northampton for a weekend. And to liven the match up, me and my friends all stuck a fiver each in. And every time there was a corner, the pot goes round. And then at the end of the game, where the pot lands, wins it. So I know you shouldn't really teach your 8-year-old children to gamble, but it can be hard to keep an 8-year-old entertained. So now, to keep my 8-year-old entertained, we play the corner game, which, as an aside, Plymouth was a classic of the corner games. It was probably the best corner game there has ever been.
Well, we had maybe 10 before we scored one. So there were lots of corners.
There
can we score from
corners
two
in the game?
There you go.
So your son booked his own holiday now, all inclusive to the Caribbean.
It's the same pound. It's the same pound. On that corner, though, the Leicester one, as someone who played very badly as centre-back for 20 years, why the heck would the team not have players on the near post? That's just unbelievable. And I mean, Gibson, fantastic. And obviously, they'd seen that Leicester don't defend with players on the post, but that, for me, is like sacrilege on a corner to not have someone on the near post.
Well, that's what they said when Man City, when John Stones scored the same goal, that I can't remember who they were playing now, but the same criticism was they've obviously noticed this team don't bother with putting men on the posts. And maybe Leicester probably will in the next game after that, don't they?
I mean, I imagine it's one of those things, to give a boring answer, where there's probably reams and reams and reams of data that say this man is better off stood in, because it's all zonal now, right? So I guess the more people you've got, the more zones you're able to cover, or the smaller the zones you're able to cover. But it doesn't count for much when Ben Gibson's able to kind of lightly push the man who's guarding the front post out the way. That's when you could really do with somebody there. So, yeah, I suppose it's one of those things that works until it doesn't. But yes, we didn't score a single court from a single corner in the year 2020. And so to get three in 3 days is quite the rush, I think. The only goals we have scored from corners. Sorry, go on, Dan.
Well, I was going to say that does rather cover up the fact we haven't scored from open play in either of those two games, but swings and roundabouts.
swings and roundabouts. As indeed is the fact that we lost, but so did everybody else. Coventry lost to Cardiff, Preston lost to Birmingham, Hull lost at Leeds, as you said, Dan, and West Brom only drew, but had also drawn on Friday, so we've kind of net gain of 1 point on them over the course of the weekend. So It's almost like being sick on a tube carriage, but there being nobody there to witness it. I promise that's the last time we'll mention that. If there's nothing else specific on the Leicester game, then and I'm looking at faces and there doesn't appear to be. Let's talk a bit more about Plymouth. Obviously, we've kind of done the corner goals, but Sarge at it again, 8 league games in a row at Carrow Road that he scored, 9 that he's done personally, if you count the Millwall game before he got injured. Didn't have his best game, did he, Dave? I didn't think, but that's, I mean, first Norwich City player ever to score 8 in a row at Carrow Road.
Yeah, I mean,
amazing.
He's just phenomenal, and I think he's proven me wrong, and I really didn't have him down as a regular goal scorer for us. And I do think he looks like a different player. He's faster. He was strong and busy when he joined, that's for sure. And you know, credit to Norwich. I think you can see in a few players that they've kind of beefed up and maybe got a bit physically fitter. I think Nunes is another one who is really noticeable the last few weeks that he's looks more like a, you know, befitting of the league that he's playing in. It was such a weird game though, wasn't it? I thought we were brilliant in the first half and went in losing 1-0. And then I thought we were awful in the second half and we scored 2 goals and won 2-1. I really did. I felt in the second half we lacked ideas. Again, we, you know, 2 years ago, if you'd have said to me, we're going to be crying out for Anel Hernandez, as much as I love him, I would have never believed that. But again, it was another game where we just lacked variety and just lacked the ability to have someone on to come on and change it. But to be fair, they did the job. And, you know, I think against Plymouth, given the result earlier in the season, yeah, you just got to be happy with it, that 2-1 win. And it was another entertaining day as well at Carrow Road. And those have been few and far between until the last few weeks. And for me, that's one of the biggest differences, is I feel like there's a buzz again. There's now a bit of a divide, isn't there, between the, oh, we're panicking, and the stop panicking. But actually, the atmosphere, and it was good when the goal went in for Plymouth straight away. You heard on the ball City and no boos, and that's the only atmosphere that we can have at this stage of the season to get us through, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you can sit right in the middle of that divide with the groaners and the cheerers. If you've just dropped your money and you don't see the action, of course, that's the best place to be. yeah, I mean, I actually thought the second goal, like proper limbs, as the kids say in the Barclay, really, like haven't seen anything like that for a while. And it was a good game, was it, Dan? I watched the highlights back before we came on, and I forgot how many chances Plymouth had. You know, they quite easily could have been 2 up in the first half and then had 2 or 3 more in the second.
Yeah, they didn't look like a team that were about to sack their manager, as they have done now. they looked a much better footballing side than Cardiff and Rotherham in the last few home games. And they caused us problems, I think. I mean, who really knows about it? But from watching it, it looked a little bit like we thought we'd turn up and just win. There were a lot of sort of shots from 30 yards rather than sort of trying to keep the ball a little longer and work some openings. And, you know, we did work a few openings in the first half. As Dave says, we were pretty good first half. But second half, it was stodgy. It was a team sort of realising they're in a bit of a battle, having to go a little bit sort of further above and beyond than they expected to have to do. And they didn't really create anything second half. And the crowd, although they were good, mostly there was still a lot of get it forwards, get rid. One fan near me shouted at Angus Gunn from a goal kick, get rid. but what we did do, we kept our composure at least. And the second goal from the corner came from a really nice move from us where we actually did dilly-dally, but then break the press. And that worked really nicely. But there were worrying signs. I think we've finally probably put an end to the debate who's our best left back, because Dimi is absolutely streets ahead defensively from McCallum. You can see that McCallum's barely played at left back, played most of his time at wing back instead, and he was done repeatedly. Just keeps getting caught on the like wrong side of the ball. But you know, on balance of that, he's also has a, you know, outstanding cross on him as well. But that is a little bit worried when we're coming up against Ipswich, as we'll talk about, who score a lot of their goals from building out wide and getting balls into the box. But yeah, it was fine, wasn't it? We won a game we kind of were expected to win without the free-flowing football we saw against Stoke and Rotherham and Cardiff before the break. And a big mention for Angus Gunn, who made a big save, as Brian Gunn used to do a lot for us. He made at 2-1. Yeah, another one of his big, big saves this season.
Yeah, he's been phenomenal. He really has. He's had a great season.
And I think an absolutely key moment of that game as well was when Ben Gibson kind of sort of messed up a back pass with his right foot in the first half, left it way short. And Angus was so quick off his line, he kind of had no right to get there first. But and obviously, if he hadn't have done, it would have either been an open goal or he's off the pitch. And that was kind of a moment that got lost a little bit, but he did fantastically there.
Although I have just remembered him also getting rounded for coming out too quickly and nearly giving a penalty away for coming too quickly as well.
I mean, what do we think of that one? Because I thought he pulled away, and I thought the Plymouth player, it was kind of in front of where I sit, and I didn't think it was a penalty at the time. And having watched it back, I still don't. I know the Plymouth manager was not happy, but it looked like a dive to me.
Yeah, he literally moves his foot to try and get contact, doesn't he? But I'm not sure. Well, I think not sure Gunn should have been out there in the first place, though.
That's true. Yeah. Well,
they see what I think they must practice that in training now. That draggy foot thing, wasn't it? Leaving the foot in. I think the referee was spot on. I don't think it was a penalty at all. But yeah, it's not a penalty just because Gunn makes a mistake, like you say.
No, that's right. I mean, that's something that Brian Gunn certainly wouldn't have been able to have done, is get out quite as quickly as that. I mean, I know he was more sprightly in his heyday than he is now, but I think Angus is particularly quick as a goalkeeper. I mean, one point we didn't really make in the Leicester game was just how difficult McCallum found it, particularly in the first half against Fatawu. And I think we then had to kind of double up. In fact, I'm surprised that Kenny didn't kind of go across more on that side to give him a bit more help or science, but...
but then you're leaving that massive, massive gap to Sarah because we don't have another midfielder in there.
So it all comes back to the bad tactics.
I was just remembering Brian Gunn getting sent off. Was it against Liverpool when he raced out of the goalie and clattered? I've got a feeling he got sent off racing as fast as Brian could and clattered the Liverpool player and got sent off. So yeah, there's your evidence.
I like these moments where I can just plead the fifth and say I'm too young for that, I'm afraid, but I'm sure your memory's not failing you, Dave. Dan, you mentioned a number of 30-yard shots that we had. One of them in particular was pretty memorable. I mean, that Sarah free kick was, I think, had it have gone in, might have been, I mean, got to be up there with one of the best goals we've seen at Curragh, and certainly one of the best free kicks. What a strike.
It felt like the sort of free kick version of Safri's goal against Newcastle, didn't it? Just arrowed at 150 miles an hour into the, sadly not quite enough of the top corner. It's just extraordinary. Like, I mean, I can't imagine being able to hit a football anywhere. Like, just how can you hit a ball that hard with that sort of accuracy as well? It's absolutely mind blowing. And it would have been, it would have been one of the sort of great goals, I think. One of the great free kicks anyway. Obviously we've seen Madison and plenty of others, Ian Crook, etc., but I can't remember a free kick we would have scored from that far out, though.
Remember who Ian Crook is. I think that in the cold light of day it looked like a dreadful miss by Fastnacht, but then when you saw the replay, I think it's testament to how hard he hit it that it came at Fastnacht like a bullet, didn't it? And it nearly took his head off. So to be fair, I don't think it was quite the miss that it looked like in there and then.
I think Fastnacht was probably just thought, it just doesn't look right if after a shot that good, he just taps it in with his head. It's like that, that was it, the Isak assist for Jacob Murphy last season, where he kind of dribbled the length of the pit, or like one through one quadrant of the pitch, and Murphy just tapped. I think it hit the post, and Murphy just tapped it in. It's kind of like, yeah, it's always going to be remembered for the assist, that one. But yeah, hopefully he'll. We've got free kick takers sort of on both sides now, and all three corners that we scored from were taken by three different players. So weird options that we've now got. For all our set pieces, and actually one of them, Nunez, not a set piece, but scored for Chile against World Cup finalist France. That's probably the biggest, the best update that we had from the international break, given that our other two players played for Scotland, who I think lost 5-0 across their two matches, so didn't go quite so well for Angus there. I wanted to have a quick chat about Christos Jolis, who is now joint top scorer in the Bundesliga, Bundesliga 2. I'll get ahead of myself. Bundesliga 2. I don't know how you say 2 in German. I didn't do German.
Zwei.
Zwei. Thank you. Anyway, Bundesliga 2, 19 goals, 8 assists. Big game tomorrow as well against Leverkusen in the DFB Pokal semi-final. So Fortuna Düsseldorf can't afford the buyout clause is what it seems to be what's going to happen in the summer. So, Dave, where do you stand on Jolis? Obviously, we could do with more wingers at the moment, but next season, would you keep him or would you cash in?
Well, it's kind of hard to know because I feel like I've not seen enough of him. But I've obviously looked at him a couple of times and not fancied him. I felt he came back a year or so ago, he looked a bit overweight. And then I felt actually this year, he looked completely the opposite. He really looked like he'd been working hard and looked quite trim. And I thought he started this season, he looked all right in a couple of games. But I suspect that Wagner doesn't fancy him and looked at him and just doesn't think he's up to scratch. But who knows if we get a new manager? But it's probably unlikely now, isn't it? We'll get a new manager. But so I honestly don't know. But I hate, I'm sure we'll feel the same. You hate it when players go off and do a great job, when you feel like they haven't been perhaps given quite the opportunity. I saw two of those yesterday. Carlton Morris. I think he made one sub appearance for Norwich. He always looked like he had that kind of physicality that strikers need, but you never felt he was given a proper chance at Norwich. And then the other one, he actually lived on the same street as me. Harry Toffolo, playing for Nottingham Forest, another player who, whenever he kind of the rare times he played for us, looked quite good and never really got a chance. Two players now in the Premier League. So I'm always like, give them another chance because I want them to come good. So it would be a real shame to see him not given enough of an opportunity. I don't think he's been given a real long run at the club.
Yeah, I think Jamal Lewis ended up kind of getting the break that Toffolo didn't get, really, didn't he, when Farker came in? So it's one of those kind of right place, but at the wrong time. Sometimes depends who your manager is. And I guess that's the point, isn't it, Dan, is that maybe, I don't know, if there is a new manager, then maybe Jolis gets is he on his third or fourth chance here now? But under Wagner, Wagner might kind of say, well, I've seen him and don't fancy him. Thanks very much.
Yeah, how old is he now? 21 still? I mean, he's very young, isn't he? And he maybe he's a year or two more than that, but that we use the loan system to try and send players out to improve and to come back ready for us or to move them on and make money out of them. And it sounds like either way, we're going to get a good player coming back or we're going to be selling someone, hopefully, for the more than the £10 million we spent on him. I mean, I don't think I've ever watched a Bundesliga 2 game in my life, so no idea.
Even during the pandemic, everyone was watching Bundesliga.
Yeah. Can't really comment on what the quality of it is like compared to the Championship, but I mean, when we signed him, he was obviously highly rated. He'd never played a professional football match in front of a crowd because of the pandemic. At that stage, he was very raw, etc. But if he has got into a place now where he's confident, he's scoring goals and creating, then I think it'd probably be a bit remiss to not look at him again in the summer, see how he fits in with the squad. But you don't know, like as Dave, you were saying, like some players just thrive at clubs when they didn't thrive at another. Like look at Pierre-Lys Malou, he's currently winning player of the season in Ligue 1 at second placed Brest. Like who and apparently getting a French call up as well.
Unbelievable.
International break. Like, you just never quite know. What I think is probably more likely is we sell Cholis and we sort of invest in Abu Kamara next season, especially if we're still in the Championship as well, because he's having a pretty stonking season in League One by all accounts. And again, we can there's someone else we can hopefully either bring him back in and he does a job for us, or in another season, two seasons, we've got a really sort of good £20 million player on our hands. So,
I think that you're right. That probably is the more likely outcome. Christoph Scholes is 22, which is disgustingly young. Born in 2000, he's definitely not heard of Ian Crook. Like I would be confident of that. Yeah, so moving on, I mean, I don't really know what there is to say about this, but Ashley Barnes has been banned indefinitely from attending British horse racing meetings in the UK in kind of the classic Antonio Conte, all I ask for is one normal day of Norwich City, which is one of those kind of bits of news. Yeah, placed on the British Horse Racing Authority's excluded list because he did not cooperate with an ongoing British Horse Racing Authority investigation. So,
do you think he's got, if he does score for us again, do you think he's got a little horse racing celebration? Maybe some sort of galloping up his sleeve? He probably seems a bit straight down the middle for that kind of thing.
He normally just shouts, doesn't he, when he scores? So
roar.
Yeah, maybe someone could, like, one of those kind of latex horse masks, they could grab one from the side of the pitch. He could just shout in the horse's face. I don't know if that would be an unnecessary act of aggression. But yeah, I would love to see. Or maybe, you know, it's some kind of Grand National type, you know, a couple of players lying down as, you know, playing the role of fences.
Yes. Yeah.
Barnes can gallop over them.
I feel like you've spent more time thinking about this, Steve, than possibly Ashley Barnes has.
I've spent more time thinking about this than the rest of the podcast.
Maybe one of the players pretends to be a horse and Ashley Barnes rides him. You'd have to have someone quite tall, so it'd probably have to be Shane Duffy, I suppose, that Barnes gets on top of, rides around for a little bit after he's just scored the winner in the Derby on Saturday.
I feel like we've progressed a long way from Farkas on a horse to Barnes is pretending to be a horse. Yeah. But, you know, we can only hope. Anyway, moving on from that to something altogether more serious. It's the first podcast that we've done since Stuart Webber's comments about a group of black and minority ethnic players the weekend before last. The dust has settled a little bit, but it was obviously big news at the time, so felt worthy of discussion. Bear with me while I read out a few statements here and just kind of go chronologically through the version of events. So Stuart Webber did an interview with The Pinken, who put out a tweet on Saturday, 23rd of March, which they've since deleted, which quotes him, where Webber has said, "Johnny Rowe wouldn't mind me saying it, but him, Abu Kamara, Max Aarons, Jamal Lewis, Raheem Sterling, where they came from, it had to work out for them in football because the alternative is potentially jail or something else." Kind of goes without saying that those five, one thing they all have in common is that they're black and minority ethnic players. Subsequent to that, Max Aaron's mother, Mel, criticised the comments on Twitter, and Abu Kamara released a statement on social media the following day where he said, "I want to say to all the black and ethnic minority children, you don't have to be a professional athlete to avoid living a life of crime. And it is important that younger audiences are not left with this false narrative. I'm proud of where I come from and acknowledge the sacrifices my family have made in order for me to have a career in football. These remarks are a sign that there is a long way to go to be treated equally." Fast forward to Monday, and Norwich City Football Club released a statement saying, "The club would like to make it clear that some of the comments in this interview do not in any way reflect the wider views of the football club. Following publication of the interview, club representatives have focused on speaking directly with Abu Kamara and Jonathan Rowe to understand their concerns and offer support. The club are also in the process of reaching out to the other named players whilst also engaging in dialogue with Kick It Out. Norwich City is a home for everyone. We remain committed in our work across equality, diversity and inclusion to create an environment where all can feel welcome and valued." Since his original comments, Webber has publicly apologised and is said to be gutted and to have reached out to the players and their families. Sorry, that's rather a lot. Kind of wanted to spell out exactly where we were with all of this. Dan, I went back and listened to the podcast that we did in November on Webber, actually. And in that, you kind of remarked on his occasional outspokenness and lack of professionalism, possibly in interviews when things weren't going well. This is sort of the perfect example of this, really. And it's hard to know what he was thinking, really, but it just all feels so unnecessary, doesn't it?
Yeah. I guess what we don't want to do is go in the ins and outs and why it was published, etc. But what I would say is that we've moved into April now, so Webber is no longer an employee of the football club. And that really, from his behaviour over the last 18 months, can only be a good thing. His job was to champion and support Norwich City, its players and its staff. And he increasingly failed to do that one job that he had. And he became a man who was sort of more interested in talking about himself rather than talking about his role and about the football club. And I think to try and sort of get a positive out of the situation is Ben Napper very much seems like a man who will only ever talk on behalf and for the football club rather than his own ends and his own opinions. With Napper, I don't think we've got a sporting director who lets his ego get in the way of his job.
Yeah. Go on, Dave.
Well, I was just going to say, we hope that's the case, but it's such a turnaround, isn't it, for Webber? Because I think when he did join the club, following on from some pretty colourful characters, in particular David McNally, alongside Paul Lambert, I mean, he felt like a breath of fresh air. I felt Stuart Webber, he was very open and honest and didn't appear to have an ego at that point. And yeah, like you say, the last 18 months, that's really unravelled. We've got no idea. We've got no idea whether Stuart Webber is a racist or not. And I'm sure he would vehemently deny any claims that he was. But that isn't really the issue at hand. You know, that's almost the fact that he didn't see that you know, there was something wrong with what he was saying is by, you know, it's unconscious racism, but it really is. And, you know, it was a terrible thing to say. And, it really was, and I don't think the club handled it particularly well in the aftermath, and I also don't feel like Stuart Webber has handled it particularly well in the aftermath. I've been very surprised to see all that has come from him is he's sorry, but not a proper statement, almost sort of a sorry through sources close to Stuart Webber type sorry, and that he's reached out to the players. Well, I don't know who in the heck is advising him on how to handle crisis situations, but that for me just doesn't cut it as well. And, you know, he should have just come out and said, you know, this was completely unacceptable. I, you know, massively apologize, rather than sort of it almost came across like he was trying to, that was a sort of brushing it aside as well. So yeah, it's a pretty, and Norwich do get, you know, and lots of people have been saying, well, he's not part of the club anymore, but I do think that you know, it looks bad on us. And we know that, I was born in Norwich, and we know that at times Norfolk can have a reputation for being behind the times or backwards, as some would say, which I completely deny. But this sort of thing just goes, you know, it doesn't do us any favours. It does us no favours as a football club, and it doesn't do us any favours as a place to be either. So it was a horrible, horrible situation really, and really sorry state of affairs. And I thought the people who came out actually some credit was probably Abu Kamara with the statement, which I thought was, you know, really sensible and from the heart, but also reasonable and reasoned and just kind of probably just quelled the flames as much as anything, but made the right point that it was unacceptable what he said.
Yeah, well said. I mean, yeah, I think that obviously the people most affected by this will be the players and their families. And I'm conscious that that's not a lived experience that any of us will have had. So it's very difficult for us to empathise in that sense, but clearly an awful thing for them to hear. Just finally on this, Dan, again, not necessarily our problem, but what happens to Stuart Webber now? I mean, does he get another job in football, or can you look into the future at all? I mean, it seems amazing that someone whose stock was so high 2 or 3 years ago has fallen so far, and mostly through his own doing and things that he has said.
I mean, football is an industry where people who have made very poor decisions still get jobs, still get rewarded. But I would imagine what it has done is it means it probably won't get another job in football in the short term, maybe as quickly as he would have liked to have got back into it, because, say, you know, he was linked with Stoke. Say Stoke come out, in a relegation battle, or after they've been relegated, appointing a man who was last in the news for those comments. It's a bad look, and it's a bad look for anyone, any football club at the moment. So I think he probably has talked himself out of a job, which really he's been in the process of doing anyway over the last 2 years, talking himself out of progressively worse jobs as well down the pyramid. And you only have to look at, was it Man United wanting to poach Jason Wilcox from Southampton? You know, big clubs do take chances on recruiting sporting directors and director of footballs from the Championship. He could have been that guy 3 years ago. He certainly is no longer that guy. I don't know, like, we can get into a long sort of existential debate about second chances and third chances and stuff, but if he doesn't get another job in football, then he's only got himself to blame.
Are you going to come in, Dave?
That just highlights my point that, you know, he probably, if he'd have come out and just said a massive sorry and not an explanation, but, you know, at least given a bit of his context or whatever, I just think he could have undone a lot of that damage or some of that damage. But yeah, I think it'd be really interesting to see where he turns up next. And I don't know him, but maybe he'll turn around and move away from football full stop. And or sometimes these, you know, can go to other places in Europe or and rebuild, can't they? So who knows? Who knows? But, you know, in the modern world, these things never, they never disappear now, do they? They never disappear. It's always out there.
Yeah. I mean, unless he is kind of doing a long game and auditioning for be another pundit on Talk Sports or GB News, because he'd fit right in there at the moment.
He's got the profile. He's definitely got the profile. Okay, well, thank you very much for both of you for covering that. So,
just on a positive note, Abu Kamara has scored for Portsmouth. So another goal for Abu Kamara.
Against Derby.
Mm.
Wow, he's on fire. And yeah, who needs Jollis? We'll stick with Abu. Okay, well, in which case, I think if we're done talking about Weber, we'll talk about another thing that Norwich City fans love to discuss: Ipswich Town.
This is almost fantasy football.
Yeah, I don't really need to go into the finer details of this one, do I? Saturday, 6th of April, 12:30, Carrow Road, Ipswich Town, the visitors. Come Saturday, Norwich City's unbeaten run against them will stand at 14 years and 352 days. Dave, this would be a good one to win, wouldn't it, is my question. What's the overriding? I mean, there's so many facts at play here, right? Cementing our place in the top six. We can dent Ipswich's automatic hopes, and we can keep that unbeaten streak going. So is it sort of all of the above for you?
I just can't wait. I genuinely can't wait. For me, it's the best, you know, best game of the season. And I've always said that I would always want Ipswich to be in the same league as us, because when we're not going to be fighting to win the Premier League, we're unlikely to win either of the cups. For me, this is the kind of game that you follow football for. So I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it. Whether we'll win or not is another story. But like I said earlier, I think it's really hard to predict, because we know that Ipswich have been flying, but something just happens, doesn't it, on those derby days. And, you know, how many times over then 14 years have we thought, well, it's coming to an end this weekend. It's got to be that this weekend that will come to an end. And then Norwich just pull out a stunning performance or sneak a win and we'll get a draw. So I just don't know. Would we take a draw? I don't know. What do you reckon, guys?
I'm taking a draw. Dan, to me, it's very petty, but like that unbeaten run, as much as I agree with it, it's nice to be in the same division as them. I'm sort of happy to not be and keep that unbeaten run going. Is that just a really petty way of looking at it, Dan?
I'm happy to say that. Pint and celebrate with a pint. And if I'm exactly the same, get a draw. If we end up in a different division from them, that's just another year we can add on to our unbeaten record. absolutely fine with that. And I imagine you've both had the same conversations where all these permutations. Would you take a defeat if it means they don't go up? Would you take a win, but they do go up and we don't go up, etc.? I am the opposite of you, Dave. I find them absolutely terrifying, and a bit like, you know, I'm sat on a tube after a heavy night out, and I just find them so like anxious and inducing. I hate them until the final whistle or until, you know, 4-0 up. Although against this Ipswich team, I'd probably only be confident 4-0 up with 10 minutes to go that we might actually get a point from it. I just wanted to get over and done with, not win, and hopefully sort of what hasn't happened in the last sort of 15 years in our run, actually, it's rarely gone against the form book, the results. I guess when we first went up from League One, people thought Ipswich would beat us, but we ended up, you know, getting promoted that season, obviously. And the closest that's come to it probably is the 2-2 earlier in the season, where Ipswich were massive favourites and have been brilliant at home this season. Well done them. And and we've been atrocious away from, you know, for the majority of the season. So yeah, maybe it is upended. Ipswich play the kind of football where they sort of, it's like, you know, anything can happen. Normally they win, but anything can happen. They play it like it's sort of closing time at a pub on a Friday night and everyone's desperately trying to get their last pint. It's sort of chaos. And then that gives us a bit of hope, I think. You know, we've got the third best home record in the division. They've got the second best away record in the division. There'll almost certainly be quite a lot of goals in this, I think. And I have no idea which way it's going to end. No idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing we can all agree on, I think, is that this is a hell of a lot better than 12 months ago. As much as I am also kind of dreading Saturday, it's very, you know, it's exciting, but I am dreading it. You know, we are feeling something here, whereas last you know, ending the season with five home games without a goal is very different to the position we're in now. So I think we should relish it. Injury news, no Johnny Rowe. We know that for certain after David Wagner's post-match press conference yesterday. So it's up to somebody else to make themselves a hero.
Yes.
It's a big bluff.
What did he say?
It was April 1st. It was April the 1st. In my heart of hearts, I'm always, you know, look at football from a heart point of view first. I just thought, this is, you know, he's going to come back, isn't he? He'll come off the bench, he'll get a goal. So, you know, mate, that would be wouldn't it be a great bluff? Just announce.
I thought he said, like, we don't know whether he's going to be available.
He pretty much sort of shook his head and said, no, it's not going to happen.
Okay. It was fingers crossed.
Kept winking at the camera.
I'm very much here for Dave's theory, though. I mean, that it should certainly happen more often, where managers completely, you know, just completely bluff it and then throw someone straight into the starting lineup. That doesn't happen often enough.
Wagner definitely wouldn't do that. I mean, he buys a player and then doesn't play him for 5 months, doesn't he? Yeah. And once they're back from injury, they have to have about 3 months on the bench even then, don't they? So, but even to have him on the bench would have been a real boost, yeah, I think, for the fans. So that is a shame, especially given all we've said about our lack of options on the bench at the minute.
And
Kiefer Moores went off injured for them yesterday.
I think it was one of those where he tried to carry underneath and ended up going off. I would have to defer to Ipswich fans to know exactly who's going to replace him, but Ali El Hamadi came on for him. And Caden Jackson can play up there, but I think started. So they probably will have to do a bit of a rejig. And then, well, at the same end of the pitch, Lungi went off, obviously, for us against Leicester. So that's a hamstring. So again, who knows? It could just be a tweak, but if it's anything worse, I think we can probably rule him out for Saturday. But Shane Duffy feels like he was made for a derby with Ashley Barnes galloping on his back. That's what we want to see, isn't it?
If big Kiefer Moore is playing, then you need big Shane Duffy, don't you, to up against him. But if he's not playing, then, I don't know, like maybe Sørensen will be a bit of a miss with that bit more mobility that he has and much, much greater passing range. But I don't know. I think my biggest worry is, as we said earlier, is McCallum up against
Hutchinson
and Jack Taylor at sort of flying right back, or Tuan Zabi as well, who plays there. That's my worry. He's going to need support, McCallum is. If we sort that out, then, yeah, who knows? Maybe we can make it 15 years.
And the other side of the pitch as well will be really interesting. Leif Davis on 16 assists now. I think he's got more than anyone else in the league. But Jack Stacey, we talked about him the last time you two guys were on, is having a real renaissance, and that'll be a really interesting battle on that side of the pitch as well. Having said, I'm not looking for, I kind of can't wait. It's one of those where it's going to be on our minds all week, and I think we just probably want it over and done with and to know what the result's going to be. Dave, would you, given that you live for these kind of games, would you be happy with a Norwich City Ipswich Town playoff semi-final, say if they come third and we come sixth?
Well,
would you be up
for the that? Last time round, I was actually on a wet and dreary, but not miserable, it was good, camping weekend. So I've completely and utterly missed the last time round at Carrow Road. I had to watch it in a pub just outside Derby. It was myself, my wife, the only Norwich fans in the vicinity. So I'm well up for it. I mean, but now nah, let's have the final. Let's have the final.
Okay, can we go one better? Dan's
face. I only said that to wind Dan up. Let's have the final. We're not going to get. It's been my dream, and I probably wouldn't get tickets, but my dream to take my boys to Wembley to watch Norwich City. Against Ipswich. It's not going to happen in the FA Cup final, is it?
Do you want to put your boys through that?
Yeah, well, you know, if we happen to lose, then it's kind of like, at least it will never, ever get any worse than this as a football fan. That's really turning me.
You think I'm sick, don't you, Dan?
Why is Daddy acting so happy? I don't understand. Everyone else looks really sad. I think at this stage, I would take us beating them in the semi-finals, even if that means losing in the final, I think. At this stage, I would beat Ipswich semi-finals. And if it comes to us losing in the final, then fair enough. We probably haven't deserved to go to the Premier League this season. So that's reasonable enough.
Yeah, and that would absolutely happen as well, because we'd be so overcome with joy at all the emotion would have been spent on those two games, and then we'd have nothing left for the final, whoever it might end up being against. And we all win that way, because then we get to stay in the same division next year. So two more derbies for 2024-25. I'm not even going to ask you to call it, because I just, it's kind of what's the point, really? It could go, as you say, Dave, any one of three ways. So let's not make ourselves look stupid for 1 week at least. In which case, I will turn it to Kenny. Other business. Is there anything either of you want to get off your chest that we've not covered? If not, I'll cut it out in the edit.
Well, I've had something going around in my head all day, but it's just going to open a really, really long discussion. I've just been, what are Norwich actually good at? Like, what are we good at as a football team this season?
Apart from corners.
There's your answer, yeah. Like, we don't build up well. We don't create a lot of chances. We give up a lot of chances. We don't counter-attack well. And yet we're still, over the last 2 months in particular, beating a lot of decent sides. We're still very much in the driving seat when it comes to getting sixth spot as well. But I don't know what we're actually really good at outside of set pieces.
I mean, I can again bring some boring data into this if you like. Is that the kind of long discussion you were hoping for?
I mean, most of the data seems to point at us not being good at anything, though, right?
Yes, but there's always something. There's always something that points to us being good at something. And I think what we have been good at this season is taking chances and finishing our chances. So if you look at, and again, this is where I'm going to get slightly nerdy and technical, but
for those listening, he's just putting on his big nerd hat.
Yes, please feel free to just turn this off if you're not interested. But
here comes the abacus.
Yeah, and my giant calculator, which I keep in the living room as well. If you look at our XG versus the number of goals we've actually scored, we are the best in the division for scoring more than the chances that we create, which, yes, means that we don't necessarily play the best football, but the chances that we do get, we are taking them. And then extend that further to individuals. I haven't checked this recently, so a couple of weeks, this might be a couple of weeks old now, but Sergeant, Rowe and Sarah were all in the top five for the number of goals they've scored versus the collected XG of all their chances. So, yeah, we are, I suppose, the game at Portman Road being a case in point, right? We didn't play particularly well in that, but Rowe took the two chances that he got, and we snaffled a point out of it. So
there can't be many teams with three players and double figures for goals.
No.
Tell me how many, Steve.
I feel like Ipswich. I think Ipswich are. Don't ask me who the three are. I feel like Chaplin, Broadhead and possibly Burns, but don't quote me on that. I think they might be, and possibly Leeds as well, but I don't know that. Actually, Leicester are, because Dewsbury Hall, Vardy and Mavididi, I think, all have more than 10. But it's been a weird year for teams scoring a lot of goals. We're actually only, I think, five behind what we got in the last promotion year under Daniel Farker. So we're going to outscore that team. Wow. So there you go. There's something else we're good at. We are good at scoring goals, Dan, because
that that just backs up negative Nigels like me, though, who think that we are doing okay despite the manager, isn't it? Because we're not creating a lot of chances. We've just got good players who are good at finishing the few chances. And imagine if we were creating more chances. Well, how much better we'd be.
I suppose I would counter that by saying that's still a tactic, right? Like you can, it's, you know, it's perhaps not as aesthetically pleasing, and you're very reliant on those individuals. But if you know you've got players who can score goals and get in the position to score those goals, and you play to their strengths, then, you know, it can work, and you can win games. I feel, you know, clearly we don't have as much control.
That tactic on the training field. Don't go into good positions too often, but when you do it well, it's what?
I would say playing to those players' strengths is creating more opportunities for them to be able to score.
I feel like I'm fighting a losing battle here. But I would argue that someone like Johnny Rowe will not score as many goals under somebody who plays him out wide, whereas clearly Wagner sees somebody there who can finish opportunities and has said, get it in the box, as he said to Norfolk. So I suppose what I'm saying is, yeah, I'm kind of inclined to agree with you, but I don't think it entirely happens by accident.
I suppose like in a more disciplined system, someone like Sainz and Rowe might not get as many opportunities to be the sort of free man that they do now.
Yes, I'm just basically creating a backup for myself. But if we do sack Wagner and it all goes horribly wrong, I can say I told you so next season. But yes, as you know, Dan, I'm firmly in the pro. But that I think is what we do well. We score goals and we take our chances. Beyond that, I'm struggling a little.
Yes.
Anyway, but there we go. So that's what we're good at. And I think, as we now know the answer to that, we've got an answer to it. That's all for today's On the Ball, the Norwich City podcast that managed to go a whole episode without anybody wrongly being called Chris. Put that in the script before it actually happened, so I'm glad that it did. Make sure you subscribe to On the Ball if you haven't already. It's free on whatever your usual player is. Just search On the Ball Norwich City on your preferred social platform. Any ratings or reviews are much appreciated. And if you want to get in touch with any questions or stats, you had probably better send me a message on Twitter at NCFC Numbers. A big thank you to our guest tonight, Dave. Thank you so much for joining us. And I believe you were the optimist of the group this time.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Steve and Dan.
Thanks for coming back on, Dan. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Steve, and apologies to anyone who might have been eating at the start of the podcast when I was forced into telling that story about the tube.
Yeah, I feel like we should maybe add a trigger warning in, and that's entirely my fault that all that happened. So apologies to Dan and to all you listening out there. Join us next week for what will either be a party or a wake. Don't know, but hopefully today's pod will show you that it can still be enjoyable after a defeat. Anyway, until then, never mind the danger.